Abani Ghani, everyone. This is Professor Amin Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University, Long Beach, former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We want to welcome you to the Conscious Corner, where we deal with courageous thinking and deep conversations about the experiences of the Black people in America and in the world. And we want to let you know that you found your family in a peaceful place. And we wish all of you that view this blessings without numbers and all good things without end. But we're going to get right into the show tonight. I just want to say this, first of all, we're going to start a series of discussions about the Black movement in the 60s that influenced universities, colleges all over the country, and specifically Cal State Long Beach. And we're going to have also people talk about what happened at other Cal State universities, Northridge, as well as Cal State LA, as well as San Diego State, where there was progressive movement as some brothers say, they turned them Black colleges into HBCUs, and which was a beautiful experience for many people that grew up going to those colleges at that time, with some of the faculty leaders, student leaders, and activism to get relevancy of Black people on college campuses as far as carving out social space and cultural space for them to free themselves, to be themselves. And so it's a very beautiful thing to go over this, because it's educational. And second, because it let people know that the struggle is a continuous struggle. It's not just one in which we have stopped struggling, but it's a struggle that that brought forth opportunities for the students today, and many of them being robbed of the struggle that African people were on at that time, that provided them the space that they have today. So we're gonna deal with that in a series of discussions, starting in the 60s. And then in the 70s, and then the 80s, the 90s, and up to 2004. And the struggle still continued after 2004, but we're just going to cover the role from where I, especially at Cal State Long Beach, where I retired in 2004. So we're going to get into that. But this week is very important, and we'd be reminiscent, I mean, really a dereliction of our duty, if we didn't give praise and honor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday is tomorrow. And we're going to have a brief discussion about, you know, how today's people should see him and his contribution to our liberation, our movement, and how you feel about his achievements and his legacy. So we're going to start with Brother Mashinda and let him reflect on what he knew about Dr. Martin Luther King.
Well, you know, I was a kid, you know, so growing up, you know, I was exposed to Martin Luther King at an early age. You know, I grew up with a dad that was a civil rights worker, very active in civil rights, working in unions and all those kind of things. So, you know, I got onto it early. And I think he was murdered. He was assassinated when I was a kid. But again, I remember vividly when it happened, you know, that type of thing. And so what it meant to me was, and really, you know, as I got older, understanding the civil rights movement and, you know, and what the mission was and what it was all about. You know, when you're a little kid, you might not understand it clearly about what's going on, but I think at a very young age, I had a depth of knowledge and understanding for my own, for my young age. And so, but again, it had a direct influence on me. And of course, we talk about Malcolm and other folks that I was, a privy to and understanding back then as well. But Martin Luther King was a world-renowned name, renowned person that, I kind of, admired and looked up to. And like I say, my family exposed me to that. And I remember when my dad, they had an album, I Have a Dream, and we still have that album, and it's in Compton. We have a, of course, our parents, created, built up a chest of, or a bunch of records, a bunch of albums and things like that, jazz and so forth. But in that stack, you find I Have a Dream album, and we were made to listen to it, and not, by gunpoint or anything, but it was like, hey, I want y'all to listen to this. And during that time, at a very young age, that I Have a Dream speech that was on the album. And we, we listened to that. And so it just had a profound impact on in terms of how I treat my my friends, my family, on how to be, and not only that, exposing me to, the world of politics and what's going on in the world, oppression and the struggle and things like that, so I can't, I have to say it has a direct impact on who I am, in terms of how I think, being a critical thinker, analytical thinker, and not only that, trying to be a part of the struggle, trying to, do what I can for humanity, and particularly our own people, trying to impart knowledge, and to this day, so it has a lasting effect on who I am as a person, but my dad was appointed a pallbearer at Martin Luther King's funeral, and he wasn't just some guy at the funeral. They had armbands, and they had, you were like commissioned, during the procession. So we know the famous procession when they were in, all the folks are walking with the casket, with the casket on wheels and moving forward, whatever. My dad was there, and he was one of the guys that was right there, with his armband on, that was authorized to, be kind of an honorary pallbearer. He didn't know Martin Luther King part personally, but Gus Hawkins and people that he knew back in the day, they knew that, Bill Green and different folks, they said, oh, he needs to be there, because he was an advocate, and more than an advocate, he was, he was a believer in Martin Luther King and things like that. So you can go into the international wing of Atlanta Airport, and my dad is right there, in that procession, And so me knowing that as a, as a youngster, but really as an adult, I see how it has a profound impact on how I live my daily life and how I have a yearning desire to make sure that I do what I can within my own right to try to help our people.
Okay, that's beautiful, Brother Rashidi. How you
Yes, my
doing,
brother. Brother, I'm
Rashidi?
doing great. Sorry for
Rashidi.
me. I was working. I was going to do it. I was going to talk to you guys through Zoom through my laptop. I had problems with the laptop, so I switched over to my phone. So that caused a momentary delay. So praise God, I'm here.
All right, well, good. I saw your cat just fly
Oh, that's it. Yes, my new kitten. It's
by.
4 months old. This is my new kitten,
I mean, when look, Rashid, the first part of the show, we're going to talk about Martin Luther King's birthday and what he
Yes,
means.
sir.
So you have any comment as far
Oh,
as remembering and
most
reflecting on
definitely.
Martin Luther King?
In terms of giving Martin Luther King the honor that is due him due to the work that he did for the struggle, for particularly Black people in particular, but all people in general. And that's what Martin Luther King's march, it included all people. And you saw at his marches, you know, his marches were not just with black people. He had a multiplicity of people out there with him from all ages, from all occupations, and including all ideologies, because the ideology that was they were lining up was behind Martin Luther King was regarding human rights, you know, for the people of humanity, specifically black, but in terms of everyone, generally speaking. So for that, I am extremely proud, and I was a part of all that I could do in ushering in and having that birthday become nationalized, as it should, and I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, good, good. Linda? Linda's from Florida. Yeah. You was working with various organizations in the Long Beach area, as well as your brother in your cultural center and bookstore. How do you see Martin Luther King? His birthday's tomorrow.
Oh, yes, you're absolutely correct. And everyone has already been said, and I was just sitting here thinking, I concur with everything everybody's been saying, especially when the brother was talking about as a child. And I thought back, I said, when I was a child, when Martin Luther King was killed, because of course I was in elementary school, but it had an impact on me just sitting in the classroom, and they showed his funeral on TV. And I mean, literally elementary, but I was sitting there just crying because I didn't understand the whole impact of it because I was a child, but I knew this was a man of power and a man who had conviction and care for the people, especially black people. And I was just sitting there as a child, just crying. I was like, wow. And then of course that interests me as I grew older. And you're right, I was involved with the Martin Luther King Parade. In fact, in Long Beach, we hadn't had one. So I was on the part of the committee and I sat with the councilman because I said, wait a minute, why in the world in the city of Long Beach, as large as it is, that we are not having anything in his honor? So it was four of us. We went to Mr. Smith and talked to him and got community people saying, look, we got to have at least a parade. So we ended up having a birthday unity parade in the city of Long Beach. And I'm sure it's still going on today. And every city I have lived in, I've always tried to be a part of any Martin Luther King festivals because he stood for more than what people, you know, everybody say he have a dream, which was wonderful. And I love it because he did have a dream, but it was more to it. The words that he said, if people listen to the words that he said, even about reparations, and they just, you know, people overlook that. But the man was brilliant in his own time. He was ahead of his time. But the answer to your question, I admire him. And I think we should continue on the path that he was, you know, for the humanity and for our people, especially black people.
Okay, good. Rasha Key, do you have any reflections on Martin Luther King?
Oh, yes. I was, I can say this, that I was around when Malcolm and Martin was still alive. And I was very young, you know, almost a toddler, but I started learning more about Martin Luther King when Professor Ra used to come to our school and lecture during Black History Month. And you talked about how King, he was an extraordinary student. That really stood out to me at such a young age, how studious he was. And then he's like a superhero in a sense, where you know you look at Superman and these other mythical figures. He was truly like that in a sense, where you could say, wow, this guy in the crux of the civil rights movement, how he was able to penetrate the system and do things, of course, with the help of other brave Black people that was in the struggle, the students and many just regular people that joined the movement. He just was an extraordinary figure. And he's an example of what to be. I would sum it up to say that he was advanced in humanity. And he also sacrificed his life for change. And it's somebody to look up to and emulate. That's what he is. And this is why I'm glad we're doing what we're doing, because it's right in line with what he was doing. And so it just was an extraordinary human being. And you can actually call him human, where we live in a system that's not. So very extraordinary person.
Yeah, appreciate what everybody's saying. I understand correctly. And y'all made some very extraordinary comments. I see Martin Luther King in four different stages. You know, the first one is that as a young man, he was skipped in the ninth grade and skipped in the 12th grade. You know, he entered college at an early age and ended up graduating from Morehouse, which was a special program for him to graduate from that standpoint. And enter college at an early age on a special program. He was a straight A student. And from the standpoint of using him as a role model for young people, as a young man, you know, he came up in a middle-class family. And, you know, his father was a big minister. Matter of fact, Coretta Scott's father is the one that got Martin Luther King's father into the ministry of Ebenezer Church. And that's how where he met Coretta also. And you have to understand that when he came into Montgomery and they chose him to be the leader, he didn't have to do that. I mean, he had a car. You know, he just wanted to be a minister. But he was sort of like the time called him to take on that Montgomery movement, bus boycott. But even before that, as a young man, and I use this for young people, that he was a straight A student. And, you know, above all, he represented a sense of character for young people, you know, ethical and focused on achievement. And we have to try to use that as a model to emulate for young people, that every young person should draw from his tenacity toward learning and present himself in a focused way in which he wanted to be something, and he was working hard to have the intellectual tools to be something. That's why he was such a great writer and a great speech person. And he didn't have jerry curls. He didn't have sag. He didn't sag with his pants, and he didn't fix his car up with, you know, dropping and all that type of stuff. He came in as a leader. And that's very important, because most of the time our young people use rappers as role models in today. And instead of reaching back in our history and getting people like El-Haj Malik Shabazz as role models, as young people, the system have us pay big money to choose our leaders directly and indirectly. What I mean by directly? Directly, they used to choose them. Then there were leaders that emerged on their own. Martin Luther King emerged on his own. And that's why Edgar J. Hoover said he was the most dangerous man during that period in the 60s of the Civil Rights Movement. When, you know, he started in the 50s. But at the same time, you got to remember, this is a man, the house was bombed 5 times. He was put in the penitentiary at least 3 or 4 times. And that, you know, he was stabbed by a sister in Chicago in the heart, where they said that if he would have sneezed, he would have died. You know, we don't know why that sister did it or and who put her up to it, but that, they set up an atmosphere for his martyrdom. Now, you can call it an assassination, that's what they say. But we call it his martyrdom because he knew, and Malcolm knew, how vicious this society was. And for them to step out, and they even talked to each other, said, "We both dead men." And so you gotta look at him as a martyr. And at the same time, a person that represented strength. To be nonviolent takes courage and strength in a violent society. As he said at one time, America's the biggest purveyor of violence in the world. And as most of y'all said, of course, he had a Christian movement with and an integrated movement, as Mashinda said, and Rashidi, of course, because as I said, it's like the fires that's going on today. It's good to have compassion for the Black people in Altadena, which only represented 19% of that part of Altadena, even up to today. But they're in such a small area, it looked like it's a lot of them, like in Watts. We live right in the center of Los Angeles. They called it South Central, but Watts was just a concentrated area where Black people lived. So if you grew up Black, that's all you saw. And so you think the whole world was Black, but if you didn't get out and travel and go out, you know, which we didn't do in those days, we only traveled by families to the beach or to the parks and picnics and to churches. So you never really, you saw white people on TV, you know, Black and white TV in those days. And you saw them as police and you saw them as business owners in your community. But you didn't see them as neighbors. They weren't your image. Your image was the brothers shooting dice or in the pool halls. And at the same time, hardworking brothers, fathers, because most families were intact. They were from the South and they were married. But getting back to Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King represented that tradition. You know, as I said, he was a studious young man, graduated from Morehouse. He had his master's degree at 19. So, you know, he was serious PhD at 25 and moving on. And, you know, he won Nobel Peace Prize at 39. And, this brother was doing it. And he offended a lot of, it wasn't just him. He inspired other ministers to step up, Reverend Shattersfield, of course, Abernathy, his movement was a Christian movement. That's why he started the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That was his organization. And he inspired SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, with John Lewis, who eventually became a minister. So he, Andrew Young, Reverend Jesse Jackson, all came up under his mentorship, you know, and they went on to do great things. Andrew Young became an ambassador under the Carter administration. Jesse became he started out with the Martin Luther King movement. When Martin Luther King made his transition, he started the Operation Breadbasket at first in opposition because he didn't want to go wrong with Abernathy. So he started his own argument, and then Operation Breadbasket, him and Jesse Boyd, then they moved into what they call the push, and now it's a Rainbow Coalition. That was very interesting that they took on his role model to emulate, as a spokesperson. The other thing is that Martin Luther King, as I said, had dogs put on him, put in jail. Most people would just say, I quit. That's why we have to see him as a martyr for the movement, not as a person that was assassinated by white people. That's something they did, and they profess to take credit for his demise. But if we see him as a martyr, he become heroic to us, and that's very important to me. So I see him as a martyr, a person that sacrificed his life for the good of his people, and that's a very critical thing. Second, he was a strong family man. Despite all the efforts by the FBI to accuse him of adultery, to tape his bedroom, to send his wife letters to try to get them to divorce, to disrupt his family life. They bombed his house. You gotta understand how vicious they wanted to do the Martin Luther King, didn't hold their hands up like they didn't do it, or they weren't part of it. But they created an atmosphere for his martyrdom by creating an atmosphere where there's so many racist white people that one of them was gonna come up and do something. So James Earl Ray took on his responsibility, but he was inspired by the atmosphere that the white racists created about King and collaborating Negroes that participated in alienating him and creating a situation whereas he become a martyr. There's the other profound thing is that, you know, as I was saying, he represented a strong man, married, had his children. Why is that important? Because most people, young men, don't even think about that anymore. You know, that was a goal of Black men in the 50s and 60s. To get married, have kids, raise a family, and be there for their family. And things are different. Things are different now. You know, pop culture, street culture, vulgar rap, all of those things were have influenced young people to think different from their cultural apparatus of strong families. Because the primary educational unit was a family. Martin Luther King, all his families had reached height with this. They got a nonviolent museum in Atlanta, the Martin Luther King Center that his family was running and getting corporate donations and things for. So, but the point is that his role in integrating the buses, and as they said, they didn't really want to go as far as they did for the year boycott. All they wanted was them to stop the law that a Black woman or Black person had to get off their seat and give it to a white person in the bus. That was their initial goal. But once they saw the people wouldn't even give in to that, they said, well, we're just gonna just go all out. You understand? And you remember the day of, in Memphis his martyrdom came and they James Earl Ray shot him. He was there to demonstrate for the garbage workers of Memphis and labor movement. And then he was moving into the poor people movement. And then he was going into Vietnam. You got to give praise, in my opinion, praise and respect to Martin Luther King Jr. And when he went to Washington, D.C. for the big march on Washington at that time, his speech wasn't about a dream. His speech was about America has wrote a check for justice and equality with insufficient funds. That was the title of his speech. He gave that speech to a basketball coach. I can't think of his name right now. But it was Mahalia Jackson that was in the background telling him, because she had heard him give the sermon about his dream at another church, telling him, do the dream, Martin, do the dream. And that's when he put down his notes and went into an ad lib about a dream. And that, but that the system turns him into a dreamer instead of an activist. You know, the dream, the dream, the dream. No, Martin Luther King was a revolutionary. You understand? He liberalized this country through sacrifice and martyrdom more than anybody. And so when you think about Martin Luther King, even today, when we was coming up in the 60s and 70s, Martin Luther King's birthday was very important. And we had guest speakers everywhere, schools and things of this nature. You don't see that today. You know, you don't see that today. You don't see people, you know, you have King parades and Europeans defining who King is. That's why they always talk about a dream, but they never talk about his activism. And we must always talk about his activism, his sacrifice and his commitment. And so that's why his birthday is very important, that we revitalize the recognition and the contribution he made, that many Black people wouldn't have gotten into Altadena, you know, because, you know, Altadena was all white city for years until the 60s and 50s. And they even say what contributed to the integration of Black people, affluent Black people in Altadena, affluent, was the Watts Rebellion, assassinations during the 60s included Dr. King, Malcolm, the Kennedys, and all the other leaders, Meredith, and all these other Black people that were killed, and things of this nature, and the Watts Revolt. All of that contributed to the liberalization of places like Altadena and certain parts of Long Beach, Big Benalls, and all of that stuff, because Black white people start moving out of Altadena because of integration. And that's why you got 19% of Black people in what they would call northern part of Altadena, near Lake and Allen and all of that area. And just like in Watts, people don't know Watts is surrounded by a number of white communities. South Central, you understand? Inglewood was all white at that time, and I don't even think it was incorporated. Carson wasn't even incorporated at that time. And so, you know, you have to deal with the topographic. But anyway, getting back to Martin Luther King, at the time of his martyrdom, 250 countries, not 250 countries, but many countries opened, gave him stamps. The United States didn't recognize him until 1986, but other countries had stamps of Martin Luther King on their post offices and recognition of his achievement. And that's why he became international with the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, that made him an international. That shows you how they recognized him from international. America never even gave him nothing, really, except for after his martyrdom. But while he was living, the Nobel Peace Prize was an international product. So he became an international recognized person for his achievement. And when he wrote from the Birmingham jail, a letter from Birmingham, he was talking to Black ministers who was criticizing him, saying he was a troublemaker. If you ever read the letter. I mean, you'd be surprised at the Black ministers that didn't want Martin Luther King to come to their cities, even though others did, because he drew a lot of people and they had big fundraisers. But many didn't, because they were tied to funds and favors from whites And so, but Martin Luther King, when I was coming up, I didn't follow him because I was a Malcolm X person and a street brother. And I ain't, I was in Watson, Compton, and we didn't, we weren't going to let no dogs, and we weren't nonviolent, you understand? We were not nonviolent, and we couldn't follow that. But once I got out of school and started reading about Martin and studying him, he became more profound as a leader than any of the leaders of his time because of his movement. When you can move and organize that many people, he's a great organizer. People don't even talk about that. Motivator. And he inspired, as Rashid was saying, inspiration of young people. They started using young people in the movement because that was a strategy, because the old people would lose their jobs. So they said, we need young people to help with the civil rights movement. And I mean, it was just a beautiful thing. He's probably one of the most profound brothers, contributors to the movement in the 60s and 50s that brought forth more progress in the civil rights. And then remember, there was two movements, according to Dr. Karenga and his perspective, which I agree. There was a civil rights movement and there was a Black Power movement. But we'll talk about that later in the context of the 60s when we get to that. But the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement all contribute to each other's success. And they both complement just different strategies as far as Black liberation. It was two parts of the liberation movement, civil rights and Black liberation. But no, we have to, as a people, as elders, and as academicians, like Brother Rashidi Mascagni at Centennial would always have Black History Month and have speakers. He's a math teacher, you understand? But he put on programs and other students would come to the lectures and things of this nature. But that's consciousness. We got Black students that grew up in the movement. They don't do nothing now. They're teachers, they're community people, but they don't put on programs like we did in the 60s and 70s. But as I said, we wouldn't be in the hotels that you're in today. You wouldn't be in many of the schools that you're in today. You wouldn't be in economic status that you have today if it wasn't for the Martin Luther King movement and civil rights. You understand? And that's very critical. So we honor him on his birthday, which was signed in by Reagan in 86 after serious demonstrations for years to get his birthday with Stevie Wonder, and they would march every year on his birthday to Washington, D.C., to get this government to recognize him. Well, other governments all over the world was already recognizing him. If you ever read and look at the articles, especially there was a great article in Ebony Magazine in August of 1985. If you ever can find that article, it tells you his whole history, and his quotations are in there, his stamps that from different countries is in that article, and voices from people that work with him, and give a chronology of his movement from the Montgomery movement all the way up, all what he went through. It's a beautiful spread. So we want to give cherish the memory of Martin Luther King, and don't never downplay it. And even though they probably recognize it next Monday, or this coming Monday, because they generally, his birthday is like on a Wednesday, they celebrate it on a Monday, the next Monday, and it'd be a holiday. So we give praise and thanks to Martin Luther King for that. Anybody have a response? Brother Kumba, you just came on. We was talking about how we saw Martin Luther King. You have any comment?
First, just thank you for your words. And here in Colorado, it's not just about the celebration. It's also about service. We feed about 3,000 to 4,000 people, and we have programs going throughout the week, whether if it's people talking about his life, the impact, or making sure that our students understand the civil rights movement. So we had our opening ceremony yesterday where the speech was about Let Freedom Ring. Sister by name Bianca Emerson gave a great presentation. So there'll be presentations in the state of Colorado leading up to the parade, and then we'll feed 3,000 to 4,000 people. So that's how we're celebrating in Colorado.
Good. That's excellent. Excellent. And they have some programs here too. Anybody else have a response to what's been said? All right.
I have one.
Go ahead.
Yes. From the days of old, when there was a person in Long Beach who was killed up at Hollywood Bowl, and it was a big protest about a black person, a young man, and he was killed. And a phrase came out of that struggle called a luta continua. The struggle continues.
Mm-hmm.
Struggle continues.
That's right.
Who have that consciousness to understand that we're in the struggle, that the struggle is not over. And with programs like yours, with men and women doing the things that we do to stay culturally aware and pass on. Mm-hmm. I saw someone had a sign, each one, teach one. I like, and that's, again, from the days of old.
Mm-hmm.
And for a podcast like this, I thank you, and for the men and women that are with you and participating, we are, you know, understand a luta continua.
Let's jump. Yeah, that's beautiful, brother. That's right. That's what we used to say. I'll do to continue. All right. Woo! That was deep. But listen, we're going to start a series of discussions about the Black movement in the 60s, specifically at Cal State Long Beach, up to 2004. Brother Rashidi's going to have discussions of his experience. Brother Kuhuma and other BSU members that was there, and Brother Rashidi Mascani when he was there in the 80s, and all the various movements in Long Beach. And Linda can chronologize a lot of things with the first Black mayor being elected. Dale Clinton is going to be Linda, the Grand Marshal for the Martin Luther King parade in Long Beach this year. She'd be 90-something.
Oh, awesome.
They're going to have Dale Clinton as the honorary marshal for Martin Luther King parade. And so, you know, it's very critical. You know, see, what happens is there are people that participated in the struggle in the 60s and the struggle on campuses, and they were observers, and they're people that, well, they begin to do things after the move, after the 60s, that were very profound. You know, the culture centers in Long Beach, the art with Cambone, his museum, and but they forget that Long Beach, and not just Long Beach, but throughout the LA area, it was all infused by the 60s movement. You wouldn't have educational opportunity programs if it don't be for the rebellion. See, during the Watts Rebellion, people say, why you burn up your own cities? Well, they weren't our cities. You know, we lived there, but other people ran them, you know. And those cities were violating our rights. The police were running rapid in the, you think they were running rapid in the 80s and 90s. Boy, and back in the days, if you couldn't have four people, Black people in a car without getting pulled over. It's, you know, you couldn't ride 4D. I mean, these are working men trying to get home to their families, they get pulled over. And they use any excuse. Your car was too low. Your car had too much noise. Any reason to pull you over in those days and harass you in many ways. But getting back to the point is that all of that stopped after the 60 rebellion and what? And in Detroit and in Newark and in Chicago. And even in during 68, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, there were rebellions throughout the country. You know, I mean, they really, especially in South Carolina and things of that nature, they were really, and even up in LA, people were demonstrating and they were very angry when he was, his martyrdom came to fruition as far as James Earl Ray. And even to this day, his family don't believe that James Earl Ray was the only one that was responsible for killing him. And so that's very critical too. They went to the prisons and interviewed him, and they asked for the case to be reopened and really find out the role, how this man could do what he did. I think he got all the way almost to Canada before they arrested him. You know, and then he said he was innocent, and there's a lot of stuff that people want to deal with. But getting back to the movement, so we're gonna have a strong presentation. We're gonna start with the 60s with Earl Parker. At that time, I was Arthur Montgomery, Sleepy Montgomery. Some call me Sergeant Sleepy, because I was a security guard in Watt for the Willowbrook School District. And I drove around in a white car and a police car patrolling the schools, elementary school, before Compton Unified was unified. And they took in the Willowbrook School District. And so, but I had to make a transformation from my street name and sports name, Sleepy, and to be a professor, I start thinking about it. And so I was going to change my name in 72, but I wasn't ready. Samuel Felton, who's Big Black, who played with UMass Aquila, heard me lecture. And he said, man, you need to change your name to Amun-Ra. But I wasn't ready at that time. Because when you change your name, you have to change to represent that name. And I wasn't ready to change. Like I tell everybody, I was out in the streets. You know, like I tell people all the time, and I've told y'all before, I was a Malcolm in the daytime, a Superfly at night. And when the nightclub, after hour joint, I didn't roll up on, you know. I mean, we'd go out at 12 midnight. Now I'm in the house at 12 noon. So times have changed, you know. But it was a different thing. And my son, Kumba, I graduated from Cal State Long Beach in Black Studies. He wasn't even born when I started teaching as a professor at Cal State Long Beach. He was born the year after in 71, along with Miko and Cherie. And they all got Black Studies degree. My wife had a Black Studies degree from Cal State Long Beach and a psychology degree. My son graduated from Cal State Dominguez with a Black Studies degree. So we were all in into Black Studies. That's my point. You know, Black Studies was the whole atmosphere in which my kids grew up, in which my life was built around with me and my wife. Because I didn't know she was a student of mine when I was teaching. Because, you know, I had to go in there blindfold, you know, blind from the standpoint of not getting no sexual harassment or messing with young girls, because I was young at that time. So all I did was focus on Black consciousness, and that kept my discipline. And so the point is that, you know, the commitment, and I got nieces and nephews that came to Cal State Long Beach. See, I graduated in sociology at that time. And then we would you have to give credit to Don Duren and Freddie Davis, but be proud of them was Ernie Clark, the first director of EOP was a Latino. Joe White helped start the program, but he was a professor, and it was really a Latino. Then Ernie Clark, and then a brother named Dewey. EOP. EOP used to admit 10 or 20% of their applicants by their signature. They took all that away. See, we had so much power on Cal State Long Beach campuses.
Professor Ross.
It's due to the movement of the Black Student Union, which was the leadership, but it was the overall Black student movement. The fraternities were into it, the sororities were into it, and it became a very powerful element. See, Black Student Union, there was no membership. You don't fill out no application. It's a drop-in, drop-out organization. When you have a meeting, everybody that came to the meeting was considered a member. Matter of fact, during the time of Rashidi and things of them nature and Earl Park and them, we used to claim every Black student as a member, whether they was in it or not, because, you know, that strengthened our numbers. And things of that nature. So we're going to get into that. And next week, Earl Parker will be here, Rashidi, and we're going to talk about the first part, the origin of the Black movement on Cal State Long Beach. But we're going to lay the foundation by talking about how the movement off campus is what influenced the movement on campus. And the movement on campus strengthen the community movement off campus. We took the community to the college and the college to the community. Matter of fact, the VSU in 1970 left the campus and became a community base. And the Black Studies Students Association became the catalyst of the Black movement on campus. All of that's going to come out. Now, why are we doing it? Because people don't know. And they don't know the struggles that others laid for them to be, have the dormitories that they have, to have and there was a sister named Ora Williams who came to campus as a English teacher, a literature teacher, faculty member in 68. She couldn't get an apartment near the campus. So the BSU, along with other Black students, demonstrated to get fair housing around the Long Beach, because their people were not welcoming Black people in their community. You can go to the campus, but, you know, and then you have people like the Rambos, the McBrides in Long Beach. Rambo them went to Long Beach State. He was an Olympian. DeAndrews went to Long Beach State, William Martin. DeAndrews was one of the first ones that got sort of drafted by Dallas to play football. But it wasn't a Division I sport program at that time, it was Division II. And so, yeah, I mean, it's got a rich history, and we need to document it through this Zoomcast and put it out there. And hopefully that people will play it in their classrooms as we document those things. Brother Rashidi, you want to add anything?
Oh, I'm excited to talk about those times, because those times shaped you and other professors and students that were there, shaped my life to who and how and what I am now. And mm-hmm. So I'm very excited to be talking about those times, because like you say, many people don't know. Mm-hmm. And praise God, I got there in spring of 71. As the ball was rolling and the baton was being passed by Earl Parker, I was one of the ones that Earl Parker passed the baton to. So I'll be happy to see him and talk about how the struggle began and still continues.
Okay, and then not only that, Brother Rashidi says it's a beautiful example, him with J.P. Marsh, Jeffrey Lakes.
Yes, sir.
Darrington Sampson, Sheila Ringer.
Sheila Ringer, yes, sir.
And a number of other people set the tone and laid a blueprint for other Black people to follow that was very strong. Matter of fact, what they call the Nugget was named after J.P. Marsh.
Yes, sir.
You know, and well, you know, there's a lot of things that went why they changed the name, but that was another, a brother that became vice president. We'll talk about him here, you know, all of that. But we're going to get into all that next Tuesday. Now, tomorrow night, we're going to be strong. Brother Jabbar, Asar Jabbar from Cuba, will be on tomorrow at 6. I don't know, Reverend Rashidi, remember Jerry Jabbar?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know, he was at Cal State Long Beach.
Yes, sir.
And he'll be on tomorrow. We want to ask everybody to come back. But we have to give tribute to Martin Luther King. We didn't mean to go this long. And I'm just telling you, this was a profound brother that we should see as a saint. Like, and we have to make our own saints. Just like Europeans have their saints and our people that they contributed to our forward flow. Rashiki, you want to say anything?
Oh man, I just appreciate you, Professor Ra, Brother Rashidi, Brother Mashinda, Brother Kuumba Ra, that came on tonight to let us know that he's doing a commendable thing out there in Colorado with the programs that he's putting on and contributing to. This is a beautiful thing, and we're just going to keep doing it. There's no stopping.
Yeah.
Keep doing it. Keep revitalizing. And it's just excellent. I'm in awe of all of this. So thank you, everybody. Thank you.
All right. So tomorrow, make sure you be at 6 for Asar Jabbar, Black Truth. This brother do so much research. You know, just now, the Biden administration has put in a proclamation to take Cuba off of the sponsor of terrorism list. And there's a movement by a number of countries, China, Russia, and other countries, to create a new financial process so that United States embargoes of countries would be free, they'd be free from up under them. Because right now, how the United States create the embargo is you can't really do a lot of international trade without US dollars. So they're trying to come up with a different system to get around that each country can use its own monetary system, which would indirectly free Cuba to be able to get around the boycott of America, because America punished other countries that would do business with Cuba right now, that embargo. And it really is devastating. But once they get the right to use their money, their medium of exchange on an international level, that gets around America's ability to punish other countries. And that'd be a big move if that movement catch on. South Africa's involved, a bunch of other African countries are involved. And Jabbar's gonna talk about that tomorrow. So I hope y'all come and get this education. And I wanna thank everybody for coming on tonight. It's just been a beautiful thing. And Rashidi, you know, I'm gonna be on you, be here next month, next Tuesday. Because his brother was one of the major activists, him and J.P. Marsh, on campus during the early 70s. And it was profound. It was just one beautiful thing. So we'll talk about that next week. All right?
Thank you, Father.
Okay, take it on.
Each one teach one in conscious corner.
All right. Come back to your call.